You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Much has been written about what and who accounted for the current financial crisis. Books have offered up play-by-play accounts of the demise of big banks. They've analyzed the workings of Wall Street and introduced mainstream America to the characters behind it all. In their new book, All the Devils Are Here, The Hidden History of the Financial Crisis, Bethany McLean and Jonah Sarris say that in order to understand the financial crisis, we need to look at the bigger picture, going back several decades. Among other things, they say blame should be far more widespread, including the pioneers of the subprime industry and the role government played in allowing that industry to flourish. Their book is published by Portfolio Penguin, and I'm very pleased to welcome Bethany McLean and Jonah Sarris back to our show. Hi.
Thanks for having us.
And when you began working on this, I'm assuming you thought about all those other things that had been written and didn't want to write the same stuff?
We did, but I also believe that you only have the book in you that you were going to write, and we were always interested in the roots of this and the histories of the people and the companies that were involved, and that was always the book we were going to write. So if we had moments of, oh, no, it was – Should we have chosen something different? But as I said, I don't think you can choose. You have what you're interested in.
Well, you put the blame on many players, Joe, but would you say that government is probably more to blame than all the other players? Because unlike banks and private corporations, it has a responsibility to the public?
Well, I certainly think it has a responsibility to the public, and I certainly think it let down its guard and did not protect the public in ways that were truly harmful to the nation. Having said that, you know, is government more culpable than the rating agencies? Is government more culpable than the subprime industry that basically foisted billions of dollars worth of loans on people who could never pay them back knowingly? I have a hard time saying that as one devil is worse than another devil, and government could have stopped it, but there are other things that could have stopped it as
well.
But
government also greased the wheels for this whole thing, didn't it? You say government was actually the first to securitize the modern mortgage, which at that time was not a bad thing, but has led to a lot of the problems we've seen since.
Right. Well, 2 points here. There are many big surprises to us in reporting this book. One big surprise was the involvement of the government in the early days of creating mortgage-backed securities. You tend to think of this as a Wall Street innovation, but Wall Street needed the government. It needed laws changed. It needed these government-sponsored entities, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, because they guaranteed the credit, and that's what made investors comfortable buying these securities. So you needed the government from the beginning.
And it was government policy to try to help as many people as possible to own their own homes?
Right. And that was encrusted in the ideology of not just government but everybody. And it's part of why this happened, because it became such a fixed ideology that nobody could step back and say, maybe it's not a good thing to have people who can't afford homes in homes.
Is this a typically American thing? Because we talk about the Americans all wanting to own their own homes. Could something similar have happened in Europe or South America? Do they have the same kind of mortgage systems?
They have very different mortgage systems, but what's interesting is that this bubble did take place all over the world. There was a property bubble in Spain. There was a property bubble in the UK. So you have to blame some of this, not just government policy in the U.S. exacerbated and created it, but you have to blame some of this on just loose money and the availability of debt.
What other countries don't have is the kind of systemic government support for home ownership. So Canada doesn't have a home mortgage deduction, and very few countries have a Fannie Mae and a Freddie Mac that basically guarantee most mortgages. And so we've created a system that not only worships home ownership but is completely dependent on government to provide that home ownership.
Well, what led to the creation of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac? What were the arguments used at the time?
The argument was to help home ownership by providing a buyer of mortgage loans so that your bank or savings and loan in your local area could make a mortgage loan, and then there could be this government-backed buyer that could purchase that loan, thereby freeing up the local bank to make yet more mortgage loans. And the theory behind that was actually similar to the theory of mortgage-backed securities, was that way you take a nationwide pool of capital or even an international pool of capital and you direct that pool of capital to America homeowners.
Well, they began selling mortgage-backed securities pretty soon after they were created, but were they the same kinds of mortgage-backed securities that we're familiar with today?
No, they were the initial mortgage-backed securities were different because back in the early days, you had to put 20% down to get a mortgage. You had to go jump through all sorts of hoops. Joe put it recently that you basically had to mortgage your first child or provide your first child as collateral. And that was true. So these initial mortgage-backed securities had layer upon layer of protection built into them. What that, like all financial innovation, it starts out one place and it gets taken to an extreme and becomes something very different.
Well, even with rentals, there was a time when people would not rent to you if you weren't if 1 week's salary didn't equal a month's right. pay. That's no longer the case.
Boy, I'll say. One way to think about what happened was that the invention of mortgage-backed securities, which really was a pretty benign, conceptually benign, had the effect of breaking the link between the borrower and the lender. Excuse me. Because always before, the lender held the loan on his own books. So he had a huge incentive in making sure the borrower could pay it back. Hence, 20% down. Hence, let's see what your paycheck is and what your job history is and so on and so forth. Once that link got broken, it took a while. But in time, nobody in the chain of buyers of these mortgages cared anymore whether the borrower could pay it back. And my view is that's at the absolute heart of what happened.
And when did that link get broken? When Wall Street got into the act?
Well, it got broken right away, but it took a while for the ethos to take hold that we don't care anymore, if you understand what I mean.
Well, we'll get into this whole business about whether people were doing something unethical knowingly or not. Is that what you're saying here?
No. There is certainly part of it. I mean, that's how it evolved. So first thing that happens is the bank still cares even though it's selling the loans upstream. Then gradually over time, the bank starts to care a little less. And they outsource servicing and they outsource this. And the loans really – they really don't have anything to do with the loan anymore. And then as subprime evolves, that's where – you're giving money to people who not only can't pay it back, but you're telling them to lie on their income and you don't care what their assets are and so on and so forth. And you actually – Wall Street starts to actually encourage people, banks, to make worse and worse loans because that gives them higher and higher yields.
But you're saying there's also a continuing distancing from the lender to the person who's actually getting the loan.
Right.
One of the things in here was deniability. Everybody along the way thought they were passing the responsibility off to somebody else.
Didn't legislation during the Reagan era aid Wall Street in its quest to dislodge Fannie and Freddie as the principal securitizers of traditional mortgages?
It did. There were two laws passed.
That was a democratically controlled Congress, wasn't it?
For part of that time. There were two laws passed. One was called the Secondary Mortgage Market Enhancement Act, and it goes by the slightly slippery acronym of SMEA. And that Lou Ranieri, who was one of the pioneers of mortgage-backed securities from Wall Street and was immortalized in Michael Lewis's famous book, Liar's Poker, actually called the Private Sector Existence Bill. And what he meant is if this law wasn't passed, then the mortgage market was going to remain forever government-dominated. And a second law was actually has to do with the nitty-gritty of tax treatment, but it's what really enabled Wall Street to sell these securities on to investors. And there was a big fight over that where Wall Street tried to kick Fannie Mae out of the business and Fannie Mae fought back. And both sides used homeownership as expanding homeownership as the moral right that was on their side, and it sets the stage for the mortgage market of the future.
Did Fannie Mae fight back by getting involved in the subprime market itself?
That happened years and years later through the 1990s.
Because they had resisted for a long time.
Through the 1990s, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, it's not that they were morally pure companies. It's that they were making so much money in prime mortgages, an area which they totally dominated. What we call a conforming mortgage means that it conformed to Fannie and Freddie's standards. It was only when Fannie and Freddie saw their market share slipping away as the subprime business began to dominate more and more that they began to chase that business much later in the game.
My guests are Bethany McLean of Vanity Fair, Jonah Serra of The New York Times. They've collaborated on a book called All the Devils Are Here, The Hidden History of the Financial Crisis. Why did Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac wield so much political and financial power? Investors trusted them. Banks lent them money. You say they were making a lot of money. Is that why?
Well, Bethany is the world's greatest expert on Fannie and Freddie, so I am going to let her answer that, and I may kibitz after she answers.
Well, there's this almost a fraud at the part of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which is that the government always said, we don't guarantee their debt. But everybody believed that the government did stand behind Fannie and Freddie's debt. And that gave them immense power because it enabled them to borrow money much more cheaply than any other financial institution. They were located in Washington, D.C. It gave them this closeness to the heart of power. And they wielded the weapon of home ownership in an extremely effective manner.
And didn't several of their executives go into government and then return
a constant revolving door.
So that revolving door really helped.
Absolutely. That's a great point.
They also were unafraid to use their power in a blunt way that very, very few corporations do. And it really became part of their culture. One of the surprises to me about writing this book is learning that Fannie and Freddie did not cause this crisis. It is a part of the mythology that they, you know, basically under the dictum of the Democrats, pushed the world into subprime lending to get more people into. That's really not what happened. What actually happened was that Wall Street, looking for a way around the power of Fannie and Freddie, created the subprime world to avoid Fannie and Freddie. And Fannie and Freddie jumped into subprime late only because, for business reasons, they were losing market share. It had nothing to do with ideology.
So when Wall Street did this end around, is that what led to the creation of the notorious credit default swap?
Actually, not quite. The credit default swap – I mean, one of the interesting things about this book is that all these different things are happening. Risk management tools are being created. Credit default swaps are being created.
Somebody comes up with an idea and everybody says, oh, gee, that's working. Right. Let's do it ourselves.
Well, yes, J.P. Morgan creates credit default swaps. Other people copy it. It becomes a very interesting tool for Wall Street to shift risk from one person to another, from one entity to another. And it takes a while before the credit default swap gets glomped onto the mortgage-backed security and helps wreak havoc on the world. But when they started, they had nothing to do with each other. It just took a while for them to come together.
For those who may not know what tranching is, can you explain how a mortgage-backed security gets broken down to seemingly make everyone look like a winner?
You know, it actually, at the heart of it, the math works. It depends on how you do the math. The basic idea is that you'll take all homeowners' payments coming in on mortgages, and you'll send them all to the safest class of securities first. So you can see how if you had a collection of really risky mortgages, but you said this 10% at the top is going to get all the cash flows first from people's mortgage payments, you know what? That 10% slice or tranche might actually be pretty safe. But what happened over time is that the standards got lowered and lowered and lowered until you had these very risky mortgages, yet coming out of this pool of very risky mortgages, a huge chunk, some 70%, was getting a AAA rating, meaning it was supposedly as safe as U.S. government debt. So the trick is always in the numbers themselves.
My guests are Bethany McLean, contributing editor to Vanity Fair, known for her work on the Enron scandal. She was co-author of The Smartest Guys in the Room. And Joe Nocera is a business columnist for The New York Times, staff writer for The New York Times Magazine. They have collaborated on a book called All the Devils Are Here, The Hidden History of the Financial Crisis. It is published by Portfolio Penguin. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with Bethany McLean and Joe Nocera. They have collaborated on a book called All the Devils Are Here, The Hidden History of the Financial Crisis, which is published by Portfolio Penguin. Joe, didn't savvy investors see subprime as a huge risk?
No.
They were simply paying attention to the ratings agencies?
Right.
Said they
well,
were
first
okay?
of all, first of all, is the question of how savvy they were. So one of the reasons AAA was so popular was because under the law, there are large classes of investors, pension funds, money market funds, and so on, that can only buy investment-grade bonds under the law. So they need a AAA or something, a fairly high rating. And there are thousands of these bonds out there. And, you know, is it possible for them to have done the appropriate investigation and due diligence the way somebody does when they buy a stock? Absolutely. But as a general rule, they didn't. They viewed the rating agencies as having done their homework for them.
And when did things go wrong? Why did the ratings agencies let us all down?
Well, the rating agencies had always been kind of slow, sluggish companies green-eye-shade companies, maybe for lack of a better word, that rated corporate and, you know, very simple municipal government bonds. And this new area of finance cropped up called structured finance, which is things like mortgage-backed securities, various kinds of asset-backed securities that were tranched, where the theory was that the top tranches were always really safe and should be rated AAA. And they all got their risk models. And it became a more go-go business. And it became structured finance was very, very profitable.
Now, what would have happened if the ratings agencies had said to these companies that they were rating, you know, this stuff is junk?
The whole facade would have stopped. The dance would have stopped the day the rating agencies said that.
Bethany, your book looks beyond the government and private sector machinations into what's at the heart of many of these financial missteps, which is human character. Greed is always the word that comes up, but what beyond greed drives many of these key players, particularly in the corporate finance world?
I think every story of business gone wrong has a mix of ingredients, and it's always a slippery slope and always hard to define exactly what it is. But it's a mix of self-delusion, very prominently, venality, and outright corruption. And it's one of the things that makes the story of the financial crisis complicated from a human nature standpoint, and when we all set out to answer the question, why hasn't anybody gone to jail?
Well, is what they did criminal? We might say that it was unethical. Were they even asking themselves, were they doing something unethical?
In many cases, the outright criminality was done by the people at the bottom of the system, the mortgage brokers who made loans to people that were clearly fraudulent, encouraging people to lie on their applications, the Wall Street bankers who bought mortgage loans knowing that they were fraudulent and sold them on to their investors anyway. But the problem is the people sitting at the top of these companies, the ones whose name we all know and who we all want to see punished, were at a distance from it. They were at a remove from it, and it's harder to tag them with outright criminality.
Well, why was Wall Street buying up these risky mortgages that Fannie and Freddie wouldn't touch?
Money.
But if they're going to poor people who there's a good chance will not be able to pay back these loans and mortgages, then why are they so profitable?
Because in an era where home prices only went up, and when we all think that home prices only went up, if the person defaulted on their mortgage, you could still take the home and sell it out from under them, and it would be worth more than the loan was. Or even better yet, the person would never default because they could always refinance their loan, thereby paying the lender and Wall Street even more fees and keeping the loan current.
But hadn't they read about other bubbles? I mean, weren't they aware of the fact that the Dutch had a problem with tulips
a couple of centuries back?
That's
such a great question because people don't realize they're in a bubble until it ends. And I shouldn't say everybody, because one of the points we make in the book is there were lots of people who said, this is a bubble, this is crazy, this won't last, and they tended not to be listened to. There is another reason, though, I think, why these securities were so sought after. In an era when interest rates were low and going down, taking on the risk of buying a AAA, supposedly riskless tranche of a mortgage-backed security, even a subprime mortgage-backed security, gave you a higher return. It gave the investor a higher yield. Everybody was reaching for higher yield. They desperately wanted it because they want to outperform the other guy, and this is one way they got it. And so they gravitated to these things, knowing that there was risk, but thinking, well, it's AAA. How risky can it be? And, oh, by the way, there's a credit default swap on it, which means that somebody else is insuring the risk. So it's completely – everybody viewed it as free money.
But you think that in their hearts of hearts, they also felt they were helping to boost our economy while they were making a nice profit for themselves?
No, I do not.
There's not too much idealism here?
I don't think there's too much idealism at work, and I also think that people understood underneath this, the people in power in Washington and in the subprime industry always understood this wasn't about home ownership. It was never about putting people in homes. It was about enabling people to use their homes as a piggy bank and withdraw money from those homes to live.
As I discover when I do a segment like this, and we get a lot of calls from listeners who still do not really understand what subprimes are all about. Can you give us the simple definition?
Subprime mortgages, like everything else, started with a good idea. And the idea was that just because you didn't have perfect credit, that didn't mean that you couldn't have a house. But like everything, it was taken to an extreme and it expanded into anybody can get any amount of money, no matter what their qualifications. But what it means is somebody with less than pristine credit, someone who perhaps doesn't have a steady job, someone who's had a few blemishes on their credit report before, they fall into the category of subprime.
Well, I remember going to some mortgage broker at a certain point, and I can't remember how much the mortgage was for, but it was a lot. It was enough so that I would have had to work without ever eating or paying for anything for at least 10 years to pay it back. And I pointed out that it was unlikely that I was ever going to make that kind of money. And he said, oh, there's no problem. And this was a reputable mortgage broker.
And did the reason he say that, because he said,
well, I had a job and
but you'll be able to refinance in a couple of years when the interest rates go down and the payments will be lower. And that was sold to people all over the country every single day during the subprime bubble. And again, it's based on the theory housing prices can only go in one direction, up.
Susan in Manhattan left this comment on our show page. She said, when I went to real estate investing seminars in the mid-2000s, speakers would mention how after 9/11 investors pulled money out of Wall Street investments and put it into real estate. Wall Street wanted the money back, and that was part of the run-up in prices that ensued and presumably part of the derivatives feeding frenzy. Do you have any comments on that?
I think there's some truth to that, in that after the tech bubble collapsed in the early part of this decade, Wall Street was looking for the next big thing, the next area in which they could make money, and it became mortgages. And since home prices were never supposed to go down, they became a perfect vehicle for adding debt. And it became a gigantic, gigantic fee machine for Wall Street. And once it became this fee machine, it took on a life of its own, such that soon it really had nothing to do with underlying mortgages or any sort of underlying rationale. It just became about generating fees for Wall Street.
My guests are Bethany McLean and Joe Nocera. They've collaborated on a book called All the Devils Are Here, The Hidden History of the Financial Crisis. It's published by Portfolio Penguin. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. One of the names that comes up constantly in this story is Countrywide. Now, it came along around the same time as Long Beach Mortgage. They both had very distinct methods of lending. Countrywide believed that it should only lend to the healthy middle class. Long Beach was the one that went to the poor. And yet, what happened with Countrywide?
It's an interesting two parallel stories, the story of Angelo Mozilla, the CEO of Countrywide, and the story of Roland Arnall, a man who founded a company called Long Beach Mortgage and eventually created an empire that was the largest subprime lender in the country in 2004. And he's the real father of subprime lending, which is how many people in the wake of the crisis has come to see Angelo Mozilla. The truth is, Angelo Mozilla's fatal flaw was a desperation to be number one at all costs. And so as subprime lenders began to take more and more of the market, he would keep up with them at any cost. And if the subprime lender down the street was making a certain type of mortgage loan, well, then Countrywide was going to make it too. And it became this classic race to the bottom. And by virtue of Countrywide's size, it was the biggest lender in the country. That caused subprime lending to take on an importance that it otherwise never would have achieved.
Could this have happened without the support of government? I mean, wasn't new legislation being passed that actually encourages this sort of thing?
Well, there were – I would say no. There are two things that happened. One, this is one to me one of the shocking discoveries of the book that I hadn't really realized, is that the federal bank regulators, particularly the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, actively sought to force states to roll back legislation or stop taking actions to – put the brakes on subprime lending. 23 states?
I think 27
states tried to do something about subprime lending. And the federal government said, sorry, You can't do it.
Under what administration?
It was mostly under the Bush administration, but the doctrine, this doctrine of preemption, as it's called, which is that national bank regulators have a right to step in and say our institutions are free from any pesky state laws. That's a long time policy, and the Supreme Court actually upheld it. So,
the government, the federal government, is actually encouraging this kind
instead of thinking to themselves, gee, if 27 states think there's a problem here. Gosh, maybe there's a problem. Maybe we should look into it. Instead, they had this the ideological blinders on that subprime has to be good and national banks know what they're doing and these idiot states need to get out of the way.
Over half the states. Yeah. What about consumer advocates? Were they sounding any alarms?
Like
they were,
crazy.
And that was one of the big surprises to me in reporting this, was going back to the early 1990s when subprime lending was invented. Consumer advocates started complaining, this is a huge problem, take these loans away, don't give them to people, they're bad for people, people can't pay them back. The consumer advocates were pounding on the doors in Washington trying to get laws passed that would stop this, and the industry would say, well, if you pass a law, then you're going to hurt the availability of credit. That was the industry's cry then. That's still the industry's cry today.
Some defenders of the system have blamed the people seeking homes who knew that they could never earn enough to be able to pay for them.
I think it's a complicated debate because you have to believe in personal responsibility. That's at the core of a functioning world.
But I know that when somebody sticks a contract in front of my face with a lot of very small type.
At the same time, another big surprise in reporting this book was the extent to which these loans were sold, not bought. And we uncovered some Washington Mutual documents showing how Washington Mutual tried to convince people that really wanted an option arm, really wanted a safe 30-year fixed rate mortgage, to take out an option arm instead, because Washington Mutual could turn around and sell the riskier product to Wall Street for more money.
Well, Washington Mutual is no longer with us. How many of the companies engaged in these activities are gone, and how many are thriving right now?
Well, nobody's thriving. New Century's gone.
Countrywide is gone.
Countrywide's been subsumed by Bank of America.
But Bank of America was one of the prime actors in this whole thing, wasn't it? No.
No, but country. I mean, I wonder. One thing I wonder is how Bank of America feels today about the Countrywide purchase, because they're. When you hear about all the foreclosure mess going on today at Bank of America and all the problems they have with foreclosures, that's all a legacy of Countrywide. That's all a legacy of Countrywide. And, you know, the more you dig into what the Countrywide mortgage brokers did, the more unseemly it looks.
What about the role of Goldman Sachs, which has been vilified a lot since this bubble burst? Were they the real culprits here?
This story shows you both what was best and what was worst about Goldman Sachs. The thing that was best about Goldman was that, unlike every other firm on Wall Street, they didn't just talk about managing their risk. They actually did it. So they saw that this market, subprime mortgages, was headed for a disaster, and they got themselves out of the way. The reason that I say that it shows what's worst about Goldman Sachs is that they did so at the expense of their clients. And Goldman has always said that our clients' interests come first. And the whisper on Wall Street has always been, oh, no, Goldman's bottom line comes first. And this crisis proves it's Goldman's bottom line that comes first.
So here we are today, Joe. The Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission is set to release its report next month. Given the delays, disagreements, and resignations at the commission, what can we expect to come out of the findings?
You know, I don't know. I think they're under enormous deadline pressure. Certainly, they've been very helpful to us. We're very grateful. We're grateful to them, because in the course of their hearings, and this is one of the advantages of writing our book when we did, in the course of their hearings, many thousands of pages of documents and hundreds of pages of testimony were released that we were able to mine for our own book. They're supposed to be done in a month. They're scrambling. It's hard to know, really, what they're going to conclude.
Well, last July, the Democratic Congress passed a bill for financial regulatory reform that expands federal control of the markets and established the creation of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Republicans were against that reform from the outset. Now we have a Republican majority in the House. How do you see reform playing out in the future? Will the bill, is it, has anyone talked about repealing it or modifying it?
Well, the great advantage the Republicans have is that most of the regulations haven't been written yet. And the bill is really very little more than a series of suggestions for the regulators. This is the devil in the details, classic devil in the details. And the House Republicans are going to spend the next year working very hard to make sure these regulations are as minimal as possible, which I don't think is very healthy for the financial system.
I'd imagine the financial industry and the financial minds behind it are already devising the next big profit-making products.
Absolutely. But one of the really interesting things that struck me is that if you listen to the lines coming out of the financial industry about the value of financial innovation, the value of extending credit to people, they're exactly the same as they always were.
My great thanks to both of you for being on our show today, Bethany McLean of Vanity Fair, Jonas Arrow of the New York Times, who have collaborated on a book called All the Devils Are Here, The Hidden History of the Financial Crisis. The book is published by Portfolio Penguin. It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
It's been our pleasure. Thank you so much.